Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, July 18th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And please note that our shows will also be archived on DrSaputo.com.
Today you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 tips, her health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. We have a great show for you today that's going to include: could the pan you cook be causing your arthritis?
The pan you cook in.
That's right. That's better.
And is the H. pylori bacteria that's causing the ulcers in your tummy actually be able to protect you from something else?
And here we go again. More to add about the unwanted side effects of those darn NSAIDs.
And angioplasties and stents again are in the news. They're not just overdone as a preventive measure, but limited after a heart attack also. So listen and find out the only window of opportunity to agree to have one. And much, much more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Okay, so what's new, Vicki?
Well, you were talking about cooking your pans, but have you ever tried to find a pan that's not a nonstick? You know, years ago, it came out in the news about how the ingredients in Teflon and some of the other nonstick pans can be harmful to our health. And I went to go visit my son in Alaska, and I was trying to find him a pan that didn't have nonstick. And it was almost impossible.
Well, they're so convenient, aren't they?
It's just stainless steel, you know, without the nonstick materials.
Well, you look at the advantages of it is that food doesn't stick to it. You can use a lot less oil if you want to. And it's really nice, but the problem is when the temperatures get too high, you start seeing things outgassed from that Teflon that can cause problems with your health.
I remember a story about somebody that had a parakeet in their kitchen in a cage, and it died from the fumes from the Teflon.
Well, it's like the canary in the coal mine. They're the ones that are really sensitive to things like that, and they give up their life, you know, to inform us. So it boils down to.
Well, it affects our immune systems and our metabolism, and it can also cause inflammation. And now the new finding shows.
Is it linked to arthritis, to osteoarthritis? It's amazing. There was an accident where there was too much contamination in a river back in the East Coast, and what they found is that because the levels were so high, they started examining to see what kinds of effects they could find in the people who lived in the area. And sure enough, they found that there was an association of osteoarthritis that was 40% higher in people who had this compound called PFOA, which I'll leave at that because it's got a long technical name. And so now the question is, does it actually cause it, or is it just something that's associated with it? But certainly it's not something you want to have in you because it's got all of these other bad effects.
Well, another reason to get a filter in your water.
Oh, for sure. A good filter in your water at that.
Okay, the number here at Prescriptions for Health is 415-543-543. I said the number wrong. It's 888-874-4888.
That's because you're so used to the old temper we had. That was like a reflex.
Let me say it again. It's 888-874-4888 if you have any questions about your health or you want to join into our conversation.
There you go. Yep. By the way, these shows are all archived, and today's show will be archived. So be sure that if tell your friends about it because the show will be there. It'll stay up for at least a week on our site at drsaputo.com, and you can always archive it on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, many people have H. pylori, also known as Helicobacter pylori. It's the stomach bacteria that can cause stomach ulcers and stomach cancers. But here's a study to confuse the issue of H. pylori being bad and something to get rid of, because it shows that H. pylori can actually protect against allergy-induced asthma and even protect against inflammatory bowel disease. So what do we do with this information?
Well, we learn a lesson here, because what happens is, as soon as we find out something is associated with an illness of some kind, we go overboard and we don't look deeper than what we see on the surface. And so knowing that people who have an ulcer are often associated with H. pylori infections, and that those ulcers can progress later and lead to cancers of the stomach, maybe even of the esophagus, that's a big deal. We know that if you kill the microbe that's there in that setting, that the infection is likely to clear up a lot sooner. What we don't look at is the long-term effects of what have we done when we add two or three antibiotics and other drugs to our system. What have we done to the microflora of the gut, and how will that affect how our immune systems and how our general defenses will be able to continue? It's a big deal. There was just an article that came out this last week that talked about, does it matter which probiotic you use? The answer is absolutely it does. But the problem is you don't know which one your body actually needs. You've got to know what the microflora in your particular intestinal tract is. You've got to know what your health is like. And then you have to go back and correlate which microbes should be in that probiotic for my particular situation based on my intestinal microflora.
You know, when you're shopping in the health food store and you're looking for probiotics, mm-hmm. many of them will say that they have something like 3.4 billion.
Right.
So don't you think if it's got that many, it's going to hit the right ones?
No.
That's a lot.
No, because they're of only certain types. So what we're looking at here is new information that makes perfect sense, but I think is a landmark study. Because what it's doing is it's telling you there's an integral relationship, and I use that word very carefully, integral relationship meaning very important relationship between what lives in your intestinal tract and how your health is, depending on what particular problems you have with your health. So we're getting to a place where we're going to get much more sophisticated in knowing which probiotics to add, which ones not to add, and how that's going to affect our health. Now, the situation with H. pylori is particularly complex, and it reflects our ignorance and our quick start off the mark to try and do something every time something is wrong.
Well, especially since half of our population has H. pylori.
Now, that's a big statement to make. Not half of the population has a problem with ulcers or cancer. Only a very, very small number of people have that. So should we go in there then and be trying, if we find H. pylori, to get rid of it? And the answer would be, I don't think so.
Because also there's other reasons for getting ulcers than H. pylori.
Absolutely. But, I mean, even if we knew that it would clear up the ulcer, is that the only way to clear up the ulcer? And the answer is absolutely not. There are many ways to clear up ulcers. And in my patients, I hardly ever will prescribe an antibiotic or two or three as a way to try and get rid of H. pylori. Because I think the H. pylori, as we're seeing now, is protective for people who have asthma, and it's protective for people who have Crohn's disease.
And asthma's on the rise. You know, it's increasing due to all this air pollution and smoking and too much hygiene, you know, killing all the friendly bacteria and not allowing our immune systems to build up like they should, and also this exposure to antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. So when we're looking back at this whole situation of what should you do if you find that there are certain kinds of microbes that sometimes are associated with disease, the answer to me is not that we just go in there and kill them because we want to protect against getting it. It's that we look at the overall picture and try to find the least invasive, most natural way to approach the topic. And that's what we should do, of course. So when they did some studies, these scientists who published this article in the Journal of Clinical Investigation just this last July, what they did is they studied an infected mice with H. pylori bacteria right at age of a few days. And what they found was, is these mice developed a kind of immune protection against developing asthma. If they gave it much later, say several weeks later, the mice still had a tendency to be able to develop asthma, although it was still somewhat improved. So we know that there's something happening in our intestinal tract, which is the most powerful immune system we have, actually. 70% of all of our immune cells are located where? In the intestinal tract, just outside, around that interface between the inner and outer world, where it should be. And when things are out of balance, for example, when there's a so-called leaky gut syndrome and there's a increase in permeability because the pore size get too big in the intestinal tract, it lets in all kinds of molecules by virtue of their size, because the pores are bigger, that can flood the immune system and cause all kinds of reactions to it that we don't want to know about.
And that's called leaky gut syndrome.
Leaky gut, that's right.
Gross, but that's what it is.
So this whole system is one that we have to pay more attention to, not jump off the deep end, start doing all these aggressive things that kill the H. pylori bacteria if we've got an ulcer, but maybe do something to try and restore a more normal microbial environment down there the natural way. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from George from New York. Hi, George. Are you there?
You were talking about organic pans. They have a new pan now called the Green Pan. It's organic. It's supposed to be ceramic. Do you know anything about that?
Ceramic pans should be fantastic to use because they don't outgas anything. And
as long as they don't have lead in them.
That's right. You've got to be careful of that. But I doubt that if it's green certified that it's going to have lead. So actually, George, I have not heard about this pan, but intuitively it makes perfect sense, and I like the idea.
You could probably do a Google on it, too.
Well, I'm sure he knows about it. Did you want to inform us about something about it, George?
No, I just heard about them. I just thought I'd ask you.
I think it's a great idea. Go for it.
You know, another thing, while you bring up this topic again, I think people should know to stay away from these iron skillets unless they're a menstruating woman, because there's an amount of iron that can come out in those type of pans.
That's a big deal.
So
because, you know,
postmenopausal women and men don't need to cook out of an iron skillet, and they can increase your risk for cancer.
It increases your risk for premature aging, actually. Anything from skin wrinkles to cancer to heart disease. Because what happens is those iron pans put out iron molecules. And if you have too much iron in your system, it makes cancer cells grow faster, it makes infections grow faster, and it overall causes a lot of free radical damage. It makes you age faster. So that's just a little aside there, George. So thanks for calling. Have a good day. Yeah, that's a good point, Vicki. You know, 5% of the population has a disease called hemochromatosis, which means that it's iron storage disease, meaning that we tend to accumulate iron more than people who don't have gene defects that regulate iron absorption. And 5% have the recessive gene for it, which means that they will accumulate iron in amounts that are too high. And whenever those iron levels get too high, they stimulate a reaction called the Fenton reaction that stimulates the production of free radicals that are ferric in nature, and they cause a lot of premature aging, a lot of damage to proteins and to DNA, and they tend to stimulate the growth of microbes that have infection or that give you infection. So that's an interesting aside.
You know, people continue to take a dangerous class of drugs for pain and inflammation, thinking that they must be okay because they aren't narcotics and they're even advertised on TV for kids. And these are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and we've talked about these so many times, but it seems
It
seems like each week something new comes out that's harmful about these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They're also known as COX-1 and COX-2 inhibitors. Uh-huh. Some of the drugs, to go over them again quickly, are Motrin, Advil, Aleve, Voltaren, Ibuprofen, and Celebrex. Uh-huh. And now this week it came out that the chronic use of these NSAIDs doubles cardiovascular deaths in the elderly.
Yeah, well, it does do that. It also leads to a condition called atrial fibrillation. And you would think, well, how much? Well, the data showed basically that 1 in 250 people per year who take the COX-1 non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs will get atrial fibrillation, and 1 in 140 will develop atrial fibrillation if they're using the COX-2.
You know,
now, if you increase the time that you take it to over a longer period of time, so say for 10 years, and there are a lot of people taking these drugs for 10-year periods. Now your risk is 1 in 25 if you're taking something like Advil, and 1 in 14 if you're taking Celebrex. So it's not like it's just a minor thing. And it always interests me the way these articles present when they come off of the Eureka, or actually more out of Reuters News because they're big pharma controlled. It always interests me at how they tend to tell you the truth, but put it in a way that it's that it gives you the idea that it's not that big a deal. You figure if 1 in 250 people will get it, no big deal. But if you multiply that by 10 years and you're still taking those drugs like so many people are, you've got an issue here that's a big deal.
And, you know, before these studies just now came out, we already knew that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can cause 30,000 deaths a year and 300,000 hospitalizations.
That's right.
So now what's it up to?
it's going up all the time. And we need to just not take drugs so much. We've got this whole idea that drugs are the solution to our health ills. And while sometimes they provide wonderful solutions, indeed, most of the time, in fact, I'd say every time you take a drug, it's causing biochemical changes that you don't want to know anything about, and you're not likely to hear anything about it, because what's going to happen? The pharmaceutical companies are going to minimize whatever they can. We know that when Big Pharma does a study on drugs, that what they do is they slant it to look like it's a good thing to take, and they minimize the side effects. And then the doctors who are getting this misinformation, or this information that's presented in a slanted way, are using these drugs on you when you're an outpatient, but also when you're an inpatient, things can get pretty dicey. We've got to do something about cleaning up advertising in general, not just in medicine, but across the board.
Well, you know, too, when you talk about slanting things, like they try to say that it's chemo preventive for lung cancer.
Oh,
so
yeah,
I guess it would be better to take than a chemotherapy drug. You could take Celebrex for, you know, if you have cancer.
You want to look very carefully at what they're saying when they talk about chemo protection for lung cancer. This is the very earliest studies that are done that suggest it's possible there could be a lower risk for lung cancer, but there are no studies showing that there is a lower risk for developing lung cancer. And of course, they published the article, which gives you the idea when you read it that this is something you might think about if you're a smoker. Well, if you're a smoker, what you'd be thinking about? Yeah, exactly. Doesn't that make a lot more sense
than taking a Celebrex?
And look at some of the side effects that we see. And we mentioned the GI.
Let's call them unwanted effects. We had a caller last week that was critical about calling them side
effects.
And he's
so right, too. I agree with him. The GI bleeds and perforations of the gut. And it's not just the stomach. It could be in the intestines as well. The heart attacks and strokes that we just found out about a few years ago. They also block the anticoagulation effect of aspirin. Very few people know that. In fact, most doctors don't know that, because I see patients all the time coming to me who have heart problems and they're on aspirin, but they've also got pain, so they're taking Advil or Celebrex or one of the other drugs. And, of course, you just wipe out the anticoagulant effect of aspirin, so you might as well not even think about it. What they, of course, should be taking anyway.
Fish oil.
Of course. And then, of course, you get fluid retention, increased risk for congestive heart failure, hypertension. Why are these drugs on the market when we've got better ways to deal with pain? Is it because it's convenient and all you got to do is take a pill?
And there's so many wonderful alternative ways to treat pain, too.
Oh, yeah, go to the website at drsabuta.com and put in pain, and you'll get hundreds of articles that come up that will summarize that for you and give you an idea what you can do. Or better yet, if you've got pain, take our pain assessment survey. You know, which is just a 3-minute survey that will ask you about 10 or 15 questions that are yes or no. It takes you 2 or 3 minutes, and back will come all these audios and videos from me and from Nurse Vicky here talking about your specific issues that are related to pain and what you might be able to do about it. So you'll learn about things like photon stimulation, you know, the infrared light therapy, and a lot of other approaches that range from homeopathy to acupuncture. You should do that rather than take these drugs, which we know are causing terrible problems every year.
Yeah, and also DMSO is pretty helpful
neat,
for pain.
But,
you know,
tricks.
This article that we were talking about that just came out this week about how chronic NSAID use doubles cardiovascular deaths in the elderly, then they try to tell you, well, instead of taking the NSAIDs, take acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, but that has its own set of complications.
Exactly.
And besides bleeding, it can also cause bleeding.
You know, what astounds me about Tylenol or acetaminophen is it's always advertised as what doctors recommend most in the hospital. And when I read that, I just go kind of berserk. It's like, why would you give a drug to a person who is toxic and needs to detoxify something that's going to interfere with detoxification and reduce liver function. Why would you do that? It just doesn't make any sense.
Because you're hurt.
Because you're hurt.
You want something quick.
All right. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or want to join in our conversation, give us a call. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
Fable for you. It has to do with hedgehogs.
Hedgehogs?
Hedgehogs.
All right.
Anyway, it has a lesson to it. And it was the coldest winter ever, and a lot of animals were dying because of the cold. And the hedgehogs, realizing the situation, decided that they would group together to keep warm. And this way, they covered and protected themselves. But the quills of each one wounded their closest companion.
Oh, geez.
So after a while, they decided to distance themselves from one another, and they began to die off and alone and frozen. So they had to make a choice, either accept the quills of their companions or disappear from the earth. So they decided to go back to being together, and they learned to live with the little wounds caused by the close relationship with their companions in order to receive the warmth that came from the others. And this way, they were able to survive. Now, the moral of the story is that the best relationship is not the one that brings together perfect people, but when each individual learns to live with the imperfections of others and can admire the person's good qualities.
That's beautiful, Vicki.
Yeah.
I think we humans could learn that, too. You know, that's what this culture needs, is an evolution to the level of a hedgehog. We can take care of one another and think about it that way. We wait for disasters to occur, and then we all become great hedgehogs. But in the real community that we live in every day, it's everybody out for themselves. It's how to make a buck, and it might be at the expense of somebody else, rather than trying to see how much you can contribute, give, support, love, in order to make the world a better place.
And then think also about things like, you know, yesterday, actually, I was trying to pick a few blackberries, and they're just so sticky. Mm. You know, you keep getting stuck all the time.
Oh, yeah, right, the thorns.
But they're so good. And just like roses with all the thorns, and yet they're so beautiful when you pick them. And yesterday when I was at church, the sermon was about a parable about when you uproot the weeds, you might uproot the wheat along with it. And so what the parable was at harvest time to collect the weeds first and then burn them and then gather the wheat. So in other words, let them grow together and not kill the weeds until the very end.
Exactly.
When you pick them in.
Well,
and it was also kind of reminding me of probiotics and the microflora that we were talking about also. So the good and the bad, it's just part of life that we all coexist together.
Well, we should be living in community, supporting one another. I mean, we got to go back to the future, to the ancient indigenous healing systems and cultures that did that. And it's not like any of them flourished as they could have, because here we are after all time has passed, and we're the most recent generation of people, of human beings on the planet, and we're still fighting with that. When are we going to evolve to a higher level of consciousness where we could fix all the problems that we see in our community just by sticking together? Instead, we're out trying to fight everything. We've got Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians, and it's not about supporting something. It's about trying to be dominant and have a corner on the market and have as much money as we can. And we forget about the reason why we're here, which is to communicate, to support one another, and to live in community. I love the hedgehog story.
Thank you. The number here at Prescriptions for Health is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Recently we were talking about this study that came out about angioplasties and stents and how they're overdone in an attempt to prevent heart attacks when there's a narrowing in the coronary arteries.
Right.
And now this week, these same invasive procedures are brought to light again. Regarding the guidelines that actually were established by a trial in 2006 showing that these same procedures are not effective when they're done more than 24 hours after a heart attack. So in other words, I guess the only window of opportunity would be during the heart attack.
Look, there are times when you really want to rely on mainstream Western medicine, because it's fantastic when it comes to things like this. the technology is unbelievable, and we should revere that and use it whenever we can when it's indicated. But overusing it makes it our enemy.
And just because something sounds like it makes sense doesn't mean that that's a fact.
We've got studies that show it. If you have a heart attack and you get in there within a few hours after that heart attack, and it's a major block, okay, in the widowmaker artery, there's a lot you can do to dissolve that clot or to do something to open up that artery so it doesn't kill all the tissue that's distal to where that block is. So it's important that you go to the hospital immediately. I mean, so many people, the last thing they want to do is go to the hospital. And I don't blame anybody who doesn't want to go to a hospital. If you've got chest pain or you're having a stroke, those are two times. Chew up a couple of aspirins, okay? That's a time to use your aspirin. And get yourself by ambulance or as fast as you can, have someone drive you to the emergency room so they can assess and see what's going on. Because if you wait more than a certain period of time, it doesn't work. They can't clear it. And too many procedures are being done, as Vicki was saying, on people who have had heart attacks with major blocks 24 hours or so after the heart attack has occurred.
And
that's too late.
Yeah, they're showing now that it doesn't save lives.
Well, we've known that for some time by that study that you mentioned. And yet, there's still a tendency on the part of families to say, oh, we have to do something. And it's like, yeah, if you want to do something, do it now. Soon as it happens, don't wait.
Don't think about that one.
Don't wait.
But this is why it's good for people to be aware of this, like what we're talking about now. So if something like this happens, that you'll be prepared and you'll know something about it. You know, there were 600,000 angioplasties and stents that were done last year, and it cost the U.S. $12 billion.
That's another way to look at it. That's right.
And a lot of them are not necessary. And some of them can be dangerous. You know, this is an invasive procedure.
Oh, for sure.
If you have an angioplasty, you could get an infection.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a stent, you could get a blood clot.
Down the road, you could, yes. And if you're in there messing around with a coronary artery, you can rupture it. That's why they have a heart team, the surgeons, standing by when you do that, so that if you do that, they've got the OR ready to go so they can go ahead and stop that bleeding and do a bypass procedure. So it's not like it's something that's absolutely guaranteed to be safe. Plus, you're getting all this radiation at the time, too, which is not a small factor.
Yeah.
And you're getting chemicals, okay, that are injected into your body that are contrast materials that are used to show up the blocks in the arteries on an x-ray.
And, you know, frequently we're putting down drugs, but this is a case where many times the drugs, the medications, can be helpful and maybe be more helpful than doing an invasive procedure.
Way better,
like this.
Way better. And what's even better than that? The healthy lifestyle. If you're smoking, stop. If you're overweight, get your weight off. If you're under a lot of stress, reduce your stress levels. If you're not getting enough sleep, make sure that you get enough sleep. All these things are very, very powerful approaches to do whatever you can to stop the effects of this disease from progressing. Then there are a lot of things that can be done in nutritional medicine. Things like L-arginine, okay, which is a wonderful new drug that our amino acid
supplement
that dilates up the arteries and tends to remove the plaque over time. There's a lot of data that suggests that that's a really powerful tool. So we've got an approach here to manage heart disease that goes way beyond just doing surgical procedures or angioplasties or putting in stents. This is something that should be put out there to the public so everybody understands it. And, of course, that's why we're highlighting that as one of our presentations this morning. Plus, there are medications that can be used. If you're not into nutritional medicine, you don't want to do the things that you can do, the coenzyme Q10, the L-carnitine, the taurine, the L-arginine, you can use things like the beta blockers or nitroglycerin because they, too, will have beneficial effects at lowering your risk for getting another heart attack. In fact, that's how the cardiologists think. And, of course, the smart way to do it is what? Is to make sure that you have an integrative approach. You want to look at the nutritional stuff. You want to look at the mainstream stuff. You want to look at lifestyle and make some kind of program that works for everybody. And if we did that, the number of heart attacks and strokes we'd have every year would drop like a lead balloon because this works. This is a great approach that can make a big difference in outcomes. So we got to keep in mind that we don't want to just do one approach. We don't want to stay out of the hospital necessarily if we're having a heart attack. All these things are things that we have to remember. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health, give us a call. We'll be taking a short station break.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
This is Dr. Vicki. I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
This is John Mappaport. Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, The John Rappaport Show.
All women, are you looking for truthful answers to help you safely and naturally navigate the many hormonal challenges that you face during your lifetime? This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, author, psychotherapist, writer, and women's health advocate. Join me entering into the Women's Healing Circle, a weekly call-in show with the holistic practitioners, authors, researchers, and wise elders who share truthful information, education, and wisdom. Join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time to enter the Women's Healing Circle right here on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda, Nurse Vicki. If you have a question about your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888.
Hospitals are crawling with germs.
We know that. That's why 5 to 10% of people who go in the hospital without an infection come back with an infection, which is a stunning number. And a lot of them are methicillin-resistant staph, and they're C. diff infections, and a lot of other things that are big challenges for our health.
And yet, you know, there's a pretty simple solution, and it's not new, because I remember when we talked about it on Prescriptions for Health years ago, and it just came out in the news, I guess it was last week, and it was like it was this big deal that copper is antimicrobial, and it's such a sensible thing to do because it kills copper, and I mean, it kills bacteria and viruses and fungus and molds and algae. They did this Department of Defense study about it. But, you know, it'd be so simple in the hospital if they just put it on, made the bed rails out of copper and the door touch plates and the doorknobs and the IV poles and the phones and the tray tables and the call buttons and the light switches.
You know, Vicki, we spend so much time philosophizing and talking and being critical about the fact that we've got these infections and who is doing what to solve the problem. You would think at least after all these years that we give our patients in the hospital, the vast majority of them, a probiotic. I mean, wouldn't that just make a lot of sense?
Well, they're so used to, everybody's so used to giving patients antibiotics, and now that we've got these resistant bugs that are resistant to the antibiotics.
So that's how you crowd them out, is give them a probiotic. And why haven't we thought about using copper on all these surfaces you're talking about? I mean, we spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars building these things, and we're using stainless steel, which probably doesn't cost any much, very much different, and it works so much better than stainless steel.
You know, if you have these germs on stainless steel, it takes 3 days for them to,
72
to go
hours,
away.
That's right.
Yeah, and if you have copper, it takes 90 minutes.
Now,
if you have the alloys, that like brass, that has a little copper in it or whatever, it takes 4.5 hours. So obviously the copper wins out here. Not like you don't need to do any other cleaning. You still have to, you know, to clean up some of the germs other ways. But there are ways to do that that are not so dangerous either, because the hospitals are also full of all these dangerous chemicals to try to kill the germs. It's kind of a vicious cycle. There's something as simple as hydrogen peroxide and vinegar. You put hydrogen peroxide in a spritzer and white vinegar in another one, and you spray one and you spray the other, and it kills all these same bacteria, viruses, and funguses too.
Well, we're busy using things that are what? Toxic. You know, if we got 5% of people have hospital-acquired infections every year, that's 100,000 people who are going to die from these infections. It's actually become the fourth leading cause of death in this country, and we know that bacteria in ICU cause 80% of the hospital-acquired infections. So it's not like it's a complicated subject that requires a rocket scientist to figure out. It's just simple common sense.
And people in the hospital, especially like in ICU, they're immunocompromised anyway. They're sick and they're vulnerable to infection.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is the Egyptians used this 5,000 years ago for infections. And a little story that's kind of interesting is that there was an article published maybe 4 or 5 years ago in one of the major journals for a treatment for vaginal bacterial infections. What they suggested is putting water in a stainless steel douche bag and using that to fight the infection, because they said it would be effective.
But that would take 72 hours. So if they use copper, that would happen fast.
Well, if they let it sit in that thing with stainless steel for 72 hours, it would probably work better. And why didn't they think of copper at that time? Because obviously that would be much better. I mean, the Egyptians knew it 5,000 years ago, because that's what they used to help sterilize infections.
Well, not only that, copper's been known for years to be healing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's copper jewelry that's known to
be anti-inflammatory
for arthritis.
Well, tell us a story about your finger.
Oh, yeah. Well, a few years ago, I had a really bad trigger thumb, and it was very painful from a repetitive stress.
I remember.
And so it was before we knew about copper being healing. It was before we did the photon stimulator and some of the other little tricks that we do for pain that are natural and healthy, healthier ways to do with it. So I went to the orthopedist, and he injected it with cortisone 3 different times. Well, the third time, he said, if you come back again, we're going to have to do surgery. And your cousin had just had surgery on his thumb, he'd gotten a methicillin-resistant staph infection in his thumb, and his thumb was a mess, and it was all open and pussy and yucky. And I thought, gosh, I don't want to do that. And you came home with this beautiful copper bracelet that one of your patients had made, and you gave it to me like as a gift. And we didn't even know that it was healing or that it was good for pain. And I just thought it was pretty, so I wore it, and I wore it to bed. And the next morning, my trigger thumb was totally gone, and my wrist didn't hurt anymore. It was just like a miracle. And then since then, I loaned it to a few other people, and they had the same results for different injuries and things.
Yeah, my brother had a tennis wrist. He wore it overnight, and his tennis wrist was gone. It was like amazing. And it's not like it always works, because you got a trigger thumb back And the second time you got it, it didn't work, although yeah. it's finally healed
again. But there are also things called copper creams and other things that have copper in them.
Exactly. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from Rick from Glen Cove. Hi, Rick. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing fine. I like your show, and I just started listening recently. My question is regarding iron mobilization to the heart by the use of vitamin C. I do have hemochromatosis. In fact, both of my siblings have died of primary liver cancer at 50. However, I'm 63 years old, and I've been doing a very extensive, aggressive supplement regimen, and recently have begun to get something like a very rapid heartbeat, and it's starting to concern me.
Are you using vitamin C as a treatment here?
I backed off on vitamin C and took a whole myriad of other antioxidants, which I'm sure you'd be familiar with. But
you've got to be really careful about that, because vitamin C is actually contraindicated in people who have hemochromatosis, because it stimulates the production of free radicals. It's quite the opposite of what you'd expect. So I wouldn't be doing that. Probably the best way to get rid of iron is the old-fashioned way, is just bleeding. All they can do is take blood out of you and try and get your ferritin, you know, down as even as low as 50, which would be miraculous probably in your case, because you have the homozygous, or you have the recessive gene. You know which kind of hemochromatosis you have?
It's actually iron-loading anemia with secondary hemochromatosis.
I see. So you've been over-treated with iron.
No. It's iron-loading anemia. It's a particular type of rare anemia that causes the body to store iron.
Okay, that's right.
Most siblings have died from it, and they were getting the standard phlebotomies. However, my anemia was so severe that I was not even able to get phlebotomies. So I took it on myself to learn everything else I could about it.
And so why did you come up with the idea of using antioxidants? Do you think that that is something that is sort of like protecting against the oxidative effects of iron?
Absolutely. Right.
And is there good literature to support that? I have to ask you that, Rick, because my take on it is vitamin C could be dangerous in that setting.
Yes, that's true, vitamin C. But I'm talking about all the other antioxidants.
I see.
The fact of the matter is, as I said, I'm 63. And they both died at 50 years old of liver cancer. I did not get the phlebotomies. They did.
Wow. That's interesting. So how high is your ferritin?
I'm not sure right now. It's been a while.
Okay. That's one number. That's one thing you want to know. There's serum iron binding capacities, and ferritin, and one other factor that's important to know when you're making an assessment about hemochromatosis. I'm sure you are. I don't know of any approaches that are unconventional that could help you with this. One resource that may be helpful is to connect with Gary Gordon. You just go put Gary Gordon, MD, into a search and ask him about what he thinks can be done for hemochromatosis. He may have some ideas for you.
Well, okay. I just want to know, would vitamin C actually mobilize iron to the heart?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure anybody does. I'm not sure the study's been done. I'd be open to hearing more about it from you. I mean, you called in for an answer, but I don't have the answer, and you're highly motivated to look it up. Maybe a Google search of vitamin C, heart, and iron might take you to that place. I may be inclined to look that up myself. I probably will. Anyway, thanks for calling.
All right, thanks.
All right, have a good day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and it's time for Vicki's last 2020 tip.
MSG, monosodium glutamate. Boy, we've all heard about that. It's found in many, many foods, especially processed foods, and it's even found in vaccines. It's a neurotoxin, it's an excitotoxin, And the thing about it is that it's hidden by other names most of the time. You know, if it weren't harmful, it wouldn't be hidden. And some of, I just want to give you a few of the names because there are many more. But things like glutamic acid and hydrolyzed vegetable proteins, they're also put HVP. Natural flavors, that's a big one. They'll say natural flavors. Yeast extract, gelatin, malted barley, who would ever think? Rice syrup and brown rice syrup. And it's even found, can even be found in infant formula. One of the things that it can do, when I say it's an excitotoxin, it can excite brain cells so much that it can kill some of the brain cells, and it can cause headaches and depression, disorientation and fatigue and even eye damage. So if you want to know more about it, just do a Google on it, and it'll talk you out of using the MSG. You know, one time I went to a Japanese restaurant, and I had some of the miso soup, I think, and I just got this flush, and I thought something bad was happening to me, and I called the waiter over, and I said, I'm really kind of scared. I said, since I ate this soup, I've just got this big flush and rush. I just feel weird. He says, oh, he says, that happens all the time with the MSG in the soup.
Oh, that's comforting.
I'll tell you.
Yeah, we know why we're making you sick, but we're not doing anything about it to change it.
I never went back there again.
Oh, geez. You know, Vicki, you are an expert in some areas, and in particular, you know a lot about healthy cosmetics and about household cleaning agents, and you have a section on our website at drsabuto.com that really talks about that and has a lot of free information on it. And with summer here, it's a good time to check out Vicki's Corner on our website to put sunscreens in the search box. You might be surprised at what she has to say about protecting yourself safely, because most commercial sunscreens are more damaging to your health than the sun. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 415. I keep doing the old one. 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health, get us a call.
And if you like our show, tell your friends about it and tell them to come and join in, because we're relatively new to Progressive Radio Network. However, we've been doing Prescriptions for Health for a long time. At what age should we do mammograms, and on who? You know, there's been a lot of controversy about when to start mammograms since the 2009 U.S. Preventative Services Task Force shifted its advice that women begin routine mammograms starting at 50 instead of 40. And that really caused an uproar and a lot of confusion, and a lot of women thought that this wasn't safe. So tell us about this new personalized study that's not based on age.
You would think that common sense would prevail. Should every woman do what every other woman does? Should everybody, is one size fits all the way we do it? That's the way the radiologists and the rest of the medical profession, and for that matter, the rest of us have been thinking about doing breast cancer screening. And yet, different women have different risks for getting it. And finally, somebody got the idea of, well, if your risks are real high, maybe you should do them. But if the risks are real low, maybe you should do them less often.
Particularly since there's all this extra radiation exposure.
Well, that's right. And so what they found is that if someone has no history of breast cancer in the family or of breast cancer themselves, they've had no previous biopsy, and they've got breasts that are not dense, that they're really in a very low risk for developing breast cancer. And so why do a test that doesn't have a return on your investment and exposes you to lots of problems? So, for example, to save one life in a woman who doesn't have these factors, if you're 40 years old, you would have to do 8,000 mammograms to save one life. And 17% of those people who had a mammogram would have a false cancer scare. Now, isn't that something? Why don't we pay attention to things like that? It's sort of like when the U.S. Preventive Task Force looked at this about a year or a year and a half ago. They came up with the idea that across the board, there wasn't any advantage of doing mammograms as a screening test in order to detect breast cancer if you're under 50 years old. And it didn't mean that you couldn't do one if there's a special situation, or that you couldn't do another screening test, particularly if you have a particularly high risk for developing it. You could. But when you're looking at people who don't have the same risk factors, then this, the necessity for doing the test falls way short. And we should be keeping that in mind.
And now they're saying that women that are over 50 that do have dense breasts, because that can increase your risk for breast cancer like four times.
Yeah, 4 to 6.
But they should have this test, and they say only every two years. But it doesn't include the BRCA 1 and 2 genes.
No, well, those, they should never have a mammogram. If you're at risk for the BRCA gene defect, that's the last thing you'd want to do, because it causes a marked increase for developing breast cancer. Just one chest x-ray before the age of 20 in somebody who has the BRCA gene defect will increase the risk for developing breast cancer by 250%. So do you really want to do a mammogram, which is far more concentrated in a smaller area, to screen for breast cancer? You're going to cause it.
So, of course, the women are going to say, so what should we do?
Well, exactly.
So what should they do besides a mammogram?
Well, that's why we have breast mammography. You know, it's underrated. It's underappreciated. It's available. It should be brought into the mainstream. There's no question that it's approved by the FDA as an adjunct to mammography.
It especially excels in detecting breast cancer in dense breast, which is where the mammograms have so much problem, and there's no radiation, and there's many, many fewer false results.
Exactly. It's an accurate, sensitive test that you can depend on, and it's safe. So why not? I don't understand why the radiologists have got this chip on their shoulder where they didn't even want to look at it. I know I've been doing, in my office, we've been offering this test because nobody else does. And I've talked to a few of the radiologists. They don't even want to have a lecture on it at Grand Rounds, which I've offered at a couple of the hospitals. They just say it's no good, and I ask them what they know about it. And basically, they say, well, it was studied years ago, and we know that it doesn't work. And it's like, why don't you do your homework and come back and talk to me? And if you don't want to do your homework, why the hell then don't you invite me to your radiology groups and have me make a presentation? And then you can just shoot me down if you think you've got enough information about it. No takers. I have one radiologist that I work with that understands it and says this is a great test, and I'm for it as well, and I'll work with you so that you don't need to do a mammogram as a first screening test before doing an ultrasound, which I think is necessary in a lot of women who have abnormal breast thermograms.
So isn't that wonderful that somebody's finally open-minded enough? I know he came to your office, too.
Yeah.
Had you teach him about it and
right.
so forth. But I think that a lot of people get into a comfort zone, like they're comfortable doing the mammograms. That's what they know. That's
well, their business,
what they're
too.
Used to. They've got all the equipment. Mm-hmm. They don't want to change it.
Well, then you've got, of course, the real culprit, which is who? Big Pharma. And where's the connection there? Because it seems like it's really detached.
All the false positives?
Yeah. You wind up finding a whole bunch of cancers that don't need to be treated, namely the ductal carcinoma in situ, or those cancers that will spontaneously remit. And there are many of those that do.
That's right.
Now, if you're going to be finding all these, what does that mean for Big Pharma? It means that in the case of DCIS, they're going to be treating 98% of the people who will never die from their DCIS cancer. And that means that they're going to be causing lots of morbidity and even some mortality from doing the workup and the tests that they do, as well as the surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So this is the problem. And unfortunately, we've got our American Cancer Society supporting that. And, of course, it leads to where we are. So I love the idea that somebody's finally done a study that says, why don't we take a look at these women and see what their risks are for developing breast cancer? And then let's look back and see if it's worthwhile from a cost perspective for them to have this screening test, okay, that could be used.
Yeah, because now they're saying at least about the mammograms every 3 to 4 years
mm-hmm.
instead of every 1 to 2. So,
well, that's right.
That's if you have a low risk.
So things are changing. We've got to be scientific about this. I hate it when people who are in the mainstream assume that everything they're doing is scientific, when in fact the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, is not scientific. And then they start saying, well, you only have anecdotal evidence about some of the things that are done in complementary alternative medicine. It just makes me wonder why this arrogance, this naive arrogance, is out there when they could at least be learning something from what's been out there. And oftentimes, for thousands of years, it's survived because it works.
And because how much of medicine is science-based?
Well, that's right. That number is shockingly low. In fact, about 15% of what we do in mainstream medicine has something of a scientific basis. The other 85% doesn't. That's about tradition and common sense. And you look at the medical literature, and according to the Office of Technology Assessment, about 1% of what's published in the mainstream major journals is good science. Anyway, the lines are open here. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuto here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Sam in New Jersey. Hi, Sam. How you doing?
Hey, Dr. Len, Nurse Vicki. How are you?
Just fine, thanks.
Okay, great. Could you guys cover the topic on what's happening on the government trying to shut down nutritional ingredients and supplements?
Sure. If you have a question about it, fire away.
Well, you have all the reports and all the documents, so...
So you just want us to talk about it for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, happy to do that. Okay, do you want to do that off the air, or do you want to listen in?
Either way.
Okay, well, stay on. And if you have a question about what we're doing, let us know. Yeah, there's a big movement that's international that has to do with trying to get rid of supplements. You know, the Codex Alimentarius, I know that's not what you're pointing towards, but I want to start with that, has taken over basically in most of Europe. And what that means is that it's a powerful enough movement in Europe from the big pharmaceutical companies and other places that they have made it so that you have to have a prescription to be able to get nutritional supplements. That's a big disaster. And, of course, they've been trying to do that here in the U.S. as well, and fortunately it hasn't passed yet. But what I think Sam was worried about here is that in 1994, there was a law passed that said that we couldn't bring on new supplements without having them reviewed by the FDA. And so now there's a movement to try and stop any supplement company from having a product that wasn't approved before 1994 to be shut down and not be able to have their product. That's a huge step in the wrong direction. And really what we have to wait and see is whether or not that's going to happen. But people like you, Sam, are trying to be proactive and saying we need to do something to stop that. And I couldn't agree with you more. I think writing your congresspeople may be of some small value, but I think the main thing is that we just have to use our common sense and do what we can to continue to support by not doing so much in the way of using big pharmaceutical drugs, but leaning more towards natural medicines that are lifestyle-oriented and maybe focus more on nutritional supplements. So does that cover it the way you wanted to hear it, Sam?
That's great. I mean, most people are asleep, and you know they're not paying attention to what's happening behind the scenes, behind the big curtain of the veil of the Washington bureaus and stuff. And you know, like you said, pharmaceutical companies are trying to control everything. And unless we stand up and call and send letters to our representatives who are supposed to be representing us instead of their own agenda of, you know, getting profits or whatever from, corporate groups and stuff. Mm-hmm. Unless we stand up and voice our opinions.
We're fighting something that's really a challenge here, because what we've got is basically a conspiracy that's run through corporate America. You know, we're not a democracy anymore. What we are is an economy. And it's based on corporate democracy. Now that corporations are treated like individuals, they're able to determine how we're doing in this country. So I want to thank you for your call, Sam, and appreciate your bringing this to our attention.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you're welcome. So here we are near the end of the show. I want to thank you all for joining us. It's been great to have you with us. And we'll be back again next Monday, at 3 o'clock.
And we'd like to remind you that our live talk show covers what's new in the news and health. And so we want to take your questions every Monday afternoon on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and DrSaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time and 12 to 1 on Pacific Standard Time. And they'll also be archived on DrSaputo.com. So tell your friends and remember that lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Amen. Have a wonderful week.